So last week, we spent our time in Genesis chapter 9, the first seven verses. And Noah and the ark had come to rest in chapter 8. And in chapter 9, in those first seven verses, we see God giving direction to Noah through commands and to his sons and his wives. And he said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And he went on and established relationship for Noah and the animals. And in that relationship, he established that the animals going forward would fear man. But man was to exercise dominion over the animals. They would be food for him. They would be domesticated. God also gave direction with regard to the food, that there was a prohibition to not consume the blood. And God also instituted capital punishment, that for cases where men were killed, that the right response to that was that mankind would take the life of the one that had committed that. I'm going to use the word murder. But it also applied to animals as well. If you had an animal that took the life of a man, that animal was also to die. And as we continue forward today, we're going to see a lot more about God's interaction with mankind and animals. And so let's read Genesis chapter 9, verses 8 through 17. And as typical, I'll be looking for a volunteer to do that for us.
And God said to Noah and to his sons with him, behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark. It is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth.
All right, thank you. So we see a lot of repetition in here, don't we? God says it multiple times. What does repetition tell us?
It's important.
It's important. You see that when people do public speaking. You see it in various settings, but particularly when we see it in the scriptures, particularly in the Old Testament, that repetition is very much showing us something important. And so we'll see that repetition occur as we work our way through this verse by verse. But in verse 8 it says, then God spoke, and he spoke to Noah and his sons. But when you see God spoke, what do you visualize here? Maybe visualize, but how would you, I mean, when you hear this, when's the last time you said, God spoke to me? Be careful with that. Some folks might say yes. But in literally, in the way that we think of you and me speaking, if I say I spoke to Alan, you know what to expect out of that, right? Clearly, God is communicating with Noah with clarity. And in all probability, Noah's getting this in the form of words, right? And so here is God speaking to Noah with very clear communication. So this next question might be a little bit difficult to see where I'm going, but who did God speak to here?
Moses. Noah and his sons.
Noah and his sons. And by implication and by the typical way the language works He really was speaking probably to wife and daughters as, or and daughter-in-laws as well, right? We could shortcut this a bit and say, God was speaking to all of humanity at the time. And in reality, there's truth to that. That's a very direct, true statement. And we'll, if I don't miss it in the words here as I take you through it, we will see that as we're going through that. And so here is God talking to Noah and his sons and all of humanity. And this is very similar in terms of the communication style to what we see over in Adam in the garden, right? Let's go to Genesis 3, 8 through 13. This is just a one of the examples of when we see God interacting with mankind in the garden. Genesis 3, 8 through 13.
And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" And he said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." He said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" The man said, "The woman whom you gave to me, or to be with me, she gave me fruit of the tree, and I ate." Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this that you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate."
Yeah, and what's that?
She did it.
Yeah, she did it, yeah. Yeah, I wasn't, that isn't why I went to this passage, just to be clear. I was just looking for a good example of where God was interacting with the first establishment of the humankind on the planet. And it's interesting when you if you're like me, your mind's eye makes some images as you go through this and you kind of live it out with them, right? So how did it start out? What happened in the cool of the day?
Heard the sound of the Lord.
Heard the sound of the Lord.
And they hid.
Well, and they hid, but he was walking in the garden. Does that fit the rest of the images of God we see in the scriptures? And I don't mean like it's a conflict. I just mean somehow God was making his presence known, and it just creates a lot of questions that I have absolutely no answers for, but it's kind of fun to visualize. And so here in the cool of the day, God's walking, moving through the garden, and they're able to hear it, but they have this verbal interaction, right? And that seems very much like what's happening here with Noah. These verbal interactions are not very common in the scriptures. We're going to see it again. Well, we will. If you read through the scriptures, you'll see it again in Moses' interaction with God and others as well. There are times when God does interact in these exchanges with mankind, but it's not the norm. But in this case, God is doing that. And he's establishing the go-forward commands with Noah, and he's already done some of that in terms of be fruitful and multiply and so on, but now he's going to talk about their relationship and make some things very clear. And so we get to verse 9. He spoke to the sons in verse 8 and Noah, and now in verse 9 the first words are "now behold." And when you see those words, what does that tell you?
Listen up.
Important things coming, very significant. We might in English say, "Behold, look." But in public speaking, you're going to hear people say, "Look," or "Get this," or "Pay attention." "Don't miss this. See here." And that's exactly what's happening here as God talks. This is significant. And God starts out with, in the New American Standard, the words are, "I myself." Now, maybe kind of a silly question looking at those words, but who else is involved in what he's getting ready to say? By involved, I mean involved in establishing it.
Christ.
Well, you could say the Trinity, but this is God's action. This isn't some negotiated thing with Noah. "I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you." And so here we see God saying, I'm going to make a covenant with you. I'm going to establish it. Establish means to bring to existence. And God is there interacting with Noah. Noah shouldn't have any right to say, wait a minute, you didn't ask me about this. Noah clearly understands God is God. Noah is not. God has interacted with Noah out of his superior position, out of his deity, brought him through the flood, shown favor to Noah. Noah's not going to be wanting to argue with God, but here is God saying, here's my covenant with you. And what do we mean by covenant? What is a covenant?
Contract?
A promise?
Unbreakable.
And see, that's a thing that is accurate. And normally we would say in life, unless there's provisions for how it will be broken, and God does create covenants that are conditional. We'll talk more about that a little later. But in this case, this one's not conditional. This is a covenant. God said, I'm establishing something. This is how it's going to be. And when he uses the word covenant, in our lives today, it's hard to find a good equivalent. Because you could say contract. How many contracts wind up in court because people either don't agree on the terms or don't keep them? We could say a promise. As a dad, I'm guilty of broken promises. You might be guilty of some broken promises as well. Sin of mankind has permeated even our expectations of what it means to have a contract or to give your word. One of the ways that comes the closest is some of the older language and older expectations with regard to marriage. That's probably the closest we come to with regard to a covenant, and yet that covenant too often winds up being dissolved, doesn't it? And so when we see this word covenant here, this is strong language, and it's coming from God. And he's saying, I'm going to keep my word. I give you my word. In these days and in many days, maybe not so much in our day, but keeping a covenant was what revealed your character. If you've got a covenant and you keep it, that shows your character. If you don't keep it, that too shows your character. And so when he establishes this covenant, he said, it's with you and your descendants after you. So this covenant extends to who? All of mankind. And even as we see as we go through this, even to the whole animal kingdom. And so God is saying, here's something that I'm establishing that applies to all of those that are finding their existence because their ancestors and they themselves came through the saving act of entering the ark. So in verse 9, he says, it's with you and your descendants after you. And in verse 10, he goes on to say, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, of all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth. And so all that came out of the ark as living creatures, this is a covenant God establishes with them. Now, of course, he didn't say this to the animals. They would not have perceived it if he had, unless he did something supernatural. So this is something directed to Noah and his family for the understanding part, but it is for all of them. And then in verse 11, we get into the content of this covenant. Once again, he turns back to himself, and God says, I establish. I'm doing this. This is not a negotiated thing. It's my act as sovereign God. I establish my covenant with you and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. So when he says all flesh, you know, how do we take those words? So once again, we're this fairly simple, but in the flood was a worldwide flood. All flesh except what was on the ark was destroyed as far as air breathers. And he said, they will never again be cut off by the water of the flood. What does that word cut off mean there for us?
Killed.
Killed. Life taken away. And he goes on to say, though, neither will there be again a flood to destroy the world. You know, we sometimes lose track of, we've tried to emphasize it in here, so you probably haven't in here, but we sometimes lose track of the difference in the world that Noah left versus the one he found after the flood. The world Noah left was operating, it was ordered, there were society, there were many people, we believe billions, or at least a billion probably, many animals. Animals were domesticated. They were used for various things, probably even eating, even though God had not yet endorsed that. It certainly looks like that was their pattern. And so it was an organized, functioning world. Now, it also contained a mankind that every waking thought was evil in the eyes of God and was. And then the flood comes. And now what do we have? We have eight people. We have few animals. It is a devastated world. There has been cataclysmic judgment, and that has led to cataclysmic change. And what started it all? Well, certainly physically it was an act of God to do that. He was responding out of his judgment of mankind. And so here is God saying to Noah, I'm establishing a covenant that applies not only to you, but my created world and the living things on it. And so now let's go to verse 12. In verse 12, God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I'm making between me and you, and every living creature that is with you for all successive generations. So God says, I'm going to give you a sign that goes with this covenant, and we'll see it in a moment. But he seems to actually expand the language a bit using some different words, but the same general meaning. It applies to you, every living creature, and all successive generations. And so this is a very broad statement God is making about what he's going to do and how he's going to never again destroy the world and those that are living on it with a flood. In verse 13, then, it goes on to say, I set my bow, lost it, look again, I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of a covenant between me and the earth. So he says, I set my bow in the cloud, and this a sign. And he said, I set. So who put it there? God did. And so it's what do we call this sign that we see in the clouds yet today?
Rainbow.
Now, what is a rainbow? Well, let's talk for a few minutes regarding the physics behind it. I thought I knew what a rainbow was before I looked this up to make sure I could explain it properly. And I found out, well, there's a little bit of detail to it I didn't know. If this is a sun, and this is the observer's eyeball, okay? I know it doesn't look like an eyeball, so that's why I had to tell you what it was. But this is the observer's eyeball, and you have raindrops. This placement is important, and typically there will be darker clouds in the area that create some shadowing that helps make all this work. But the sun has to shine on the rain And when the light from the sun hits the drop, maybe I'll make that a little bigger. When it hits an individual drop, the light from the sun comes in and it actually bounces or is reflected off the back of the raindrop and is reflected back out. When it comes out, this is reflected, if you want to know terms. This is refracted. And when it's refracted back out, depending upon the angle that is created here, when it hits an observer's eyeball, we'll draw an eyeball down here, when it hits an observer's eyeball, depending on these angles, the light is split into its various colors. I don't have those memorized, but I'm sure you did when you were in school once. And when it comes out, then you're going to see a particular segment of that refracted light, the red, the blue, the green, the infrared. You're not going to see the infrared, but that's out there, and so on, the full, what we call the electromagnetic spectrum. And so when we see a rainbow, we're actually seeing off of many, many, many drops of rain. It takes a lot of drops of rain to make a rainbow. You will never see a rainbow off of a few drops, because some of those drops reflect light out that when it comes to your eye. By the way, everything you see, this is not quite true, but it's close. If you don't look at the light fixtures, everything you see in the room, what you're seeing is reflected light. All the colors hit the wall. That's not a good one to use. We'll go over here. Well, that's brown. I need something red or green or blue. But anyway, if you look at something red, what you're seeing is the light that gets reflected back. A red object absorbs all of the light except the red, or at least doesn't reflect it. I'll put it that way. And so, but this is refraction. So the light not only comes in and is reflected, but it's broken down into its colors as it's refracted coming out, and you see that portion of it. So in order for you to see a full rainbow, you have to have lots of raindrops having the light hit it and be reflected out and then refracted, and you're going to see in the upper portion, because of the angle that's created with the sun there, you're going to see one color, and as you go down through the colors, you're going to see different colors, because the angle is changing. The angle coming in here and then coming out will be different than the angle that comes in at a lower one and comes out. And it's about 40 to 48 degrees is the reflection angle that you need in order to see some of those colors. So there's a lot of raindrops that when that reflected light comes out isn't going to hit your light and show you a color. So if your idea, I mean, in a sense it's true that there's a rainbow created out here, but in reality it's that refracted light that's broken down and comes to your eyeballs that lets you see that rainbow out there.
So is there always a rainbow, Rick, and you just don't see it because your angle is wrong?
No, because I didn't say this either. The sun has to be behind the viewer. If it's in front of the viewer, if the sun's not coming from behind you, then you're not going to see it, because the sun is too bright to be between you and it and still see it, and the angles get different. But no, there's not always a rainbow, because there's not always sunlight coming through. We have a lot of rain under a cloud cover, right? So if there's a sun out there, and if we have a good rain somewhere, and you could position yourself in the right place, there would probably be a rainbow to see. But you have to have those things going on. And that's why you'll see a rainbow in one place and you'll call somebody up that maybe lives south of town or whatever and go, did you see that rainbow or a double rainbow? And, no, I didn't see a rainbow. Well, it depends on where you're at and how these things come together. Which means there's some interesting things you could never do. Once you understand this, one of the things you can't do is go find the end of that rainbow, right? There's no end to find. And we laugh about the leprechauns and their pots of gold, and I'm not going to take the time to do it today. There are some really strange myths and superstitions about rainbows. I'll give you one. There's one tribal belief, I think it was in Africa, but I'm not sure, that said if a person were to walk under the arch of the rainbow, now that's also impossible, right? You can't get there from here. As you move, it moves. And at some point, the angles are going to all change and it's going to flat disappear. But they believed if a person walked under the arch of the rainbow, their gender would flip. Now, isn't that weird? Now, I don't know if that has anything to do with some of the symbology that's been chosen in the current time for some other really bizarre things that people think about and promote. But there are limitations. So that's the physics behind the rainbow. So I have a question. Has anyone seen the rainbow colors created by something other than rain? What are some examples? A waterfall, a prism. Yeah, anything that can refract light can create this phenomenon. And if it does it in enough of the right kind of space, you're going to perceive that color refraction coming out of it and see it. But generally, we're not going to see those things in the sky without some sort of precipitation, are we? So we're not going to see this refraction and it create a rainbow in the clouds as God described here, other than a true rainbow. Does knowing the physics behind the rainbow negate the claimed sign of the covenant? There's so many things, you know, that science would say, well, now we know how that happens, so it really doesn't have anything to do with your belief or scripture or whatever. Does knowing the science affect how you look at this?
No.
Why not?
God created science.
Well, God created the universe and the way it works. That's certainly a true thing. Would the rainbow have happened before this time?
No,
why not?
No rain.
And so God was planning ahead, if you will. With the way that the rainstorm is described in the flood, the 40 days and 40 nights, you think there was the sun shining very much? The way it describes the quantity of water coming down, I would guess that might be a better word, that there was no rainbow to be seen. Let's talk about the language for a minute, the rainbow. Outside of here, this word would be translated a number of ways. When he said, I put my bow in the sky, it might be an archer, a soldier that uses a bow. It might be the bow of an archer, a weapon. It might be a figure of might. And so every other application that we see that uses this word that's translated bow here in the English is not an arch of some sort. It is a weapon type thing related to using a bow and arrow kind of a weapon in battle as an armed person. And so that leads some to think that God is intentionally bringing some of that imagery into this, in that he had unleashed his destruction on the earth. It was an offensive action of might against sinful man. It showed his wrath. Excuse me. And now he is setting aside his role of wrath, at least with rain. And this is, he's symbolically hanging his archery bow, if you will, into the sky. I don't know. That seems like a bit of a stretch for me, but as I read it, I thought, well, you know, that's an interesting concept at least. And so there it is. Regardless of whether it has anything to do with the symbolism behind some sort of an archery bow or not, I don't know what that God necessarily intended that. But it is clear that God intended this to be a sign. If we look back at 11, he says, "12, this is the sign of the covenant which I am making between me and you." And in verse 13 then, he says, "I set my bow in the cloud. And it shall be for a sign of a covenant between me and the earth." So he's using the earth as a shortcut for all those that are living. And so when he says that's a sign, this is an interesting thing for him to use as a sign, because he has placed this in the heavens to convey a spiritual meaning, right? And that spiritual meaning tells us what? This is an easy question. What is the meaning of the covenant? What's the sign of that he's put up there? No more floods. No more destructive flood. No more killing all the people and all of the animals on the planet with a flood. But I think because he uses the word sign here in the English, at least, we ought to go look at Genesis 1, 14 and 15 and distinguish a difference between what he's establishing here with the rainbow and what he established with the sun, the moon, and the stars. Genesis 1, 14 and 15. This is clear back when he's creating the sun, the moon, and the stars. And he gives them a role. And let's see what the language is there.
And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth." And it was so.
Okay. So he established these lights in the heaven, the sun, the moon, and the stars. And he says, they're going to be a sign for you. What are they a sign of? He lists it right there.
Seasons and time.
And so you can use these lights in the heavens and their positioning and whatever to tell you what the season is, what the calendar is, what time of the day is it based on the sun position. Some would like to take this and twist it to mean, oh, the zodiac was God-given. No, that use of the word sign is very different than here, because there he says, it's your calendar, it's your seasons. It's going to let you chart out where you're going through the days of the week and the months and the years and even the time of the day. Which is different than this sign. The rainbow doesn't do anything for us except remind us of God's covenant. A different kind of sign. Questions, comments so far?
Yeah, I got a question, Rick. As far as the naming, what we call it, for the rainbow, is that something that is present in like non-Judeo-Christian cultures? Do they refer to a bow as well, or are there other...
I don't know about all their terminology in terms of what they call it, but I honestly left that information on my desk. I read a whole bunch of different examples of how the rainbow is in every culture and it has some significance. And it's got all different kinds of significances. Some of them are pretty bizarre. Some of them aren't a long ways from this covenant. But most of them are very different than the covenant. Yes, sir?
Before the flood, I've heard a teaching that the waters were separated, not just by earth, but, and I think we've touched on it in this class, where there may have been something like an envelope of water above, and when the heavens opened and the fountains came up, so there wouldn't, you know, be direct sunlight and, you know, all this stuff.
Yes, those kinds of things, I have shied away from going there in this class, and there's a reason for it, but I'm probably maybe going just a little bit too far. There's a whole group of people, it's fairly large, within Christendom that believe that there was what they call a canopy, and that canopy somehow, through actually high air pressures, what they believe. They will tell you that our... Right now, we're about 14.7 PSI on the surface at sea level of air pushing down on us. They say, well, when you add the weight of the water up there, It was probably more like 35 or 40 PSI. And all this water's out there being held up there by this air pressure on the earth. The challenge is, well, let me just go this way with it. And so that's held up there, and because that water's up there, it also then, we don't get direct sunlight. We kind of get glows where the sun would be kind of more of a glow. And you would, then it's going to even out the temperatures on the earth. That's why people believe that they find tropical plants in far northern regions of the earth, along with mammoths and other animals that clearly had those, were feasting on those green plants, and so on and so on and so on. There is a piece in that we did talk about in Genesis 1 that says he separated the waters from below from the waters above. Now, were the waters above in liquid form or vapor form? And then from there, it's the same thing that evolutionists and others do. And I'm not trying to equate the logic or the conclusions, but then they start going into scientific kinds of things, studies. Well, if you're going to have this much water up there, then you got to have this kind of pressure. And oh, by the way, that would be good for us, because if the pressure was three times as much, every breath of air would give you three times as much oxygen. And they go down the road of that also talks about the long life, because without the direct sunlight, we're going to have a lot less cancers. And because of all that oxygen that's getting into your bloodstream, your body's going to function a lot better. By the way, that's necessary for the height of the long-legged dinosaurs. Under 14.7 PSI, their blood, they could not get enough oxygen in their blood, and their blood couldn't get up high enough, but with under the pressure. And they get all these kinds of reasonings that go on that are not in style different reasonings than what the evolutionists do. And so I hesitate to go there because I just don't see it in the scriptures, number one. Number two, the other reason I don't go there, I'll come right back to second, Royce. The other reason I don't go there is what we just read. God said you can use the sun and the stars and the moon for seasons and so on. If we had that, you would never see the stars. So I kind of go, that's a problem for me. So I just kind of, I don't bring forth that kind of a theory, because I think it's got as many problems as it does solutions. Now, what did you want to say?
Well, I agree with that. We try to get too specific and nail things down. But I thought that would help explain the physics of not having a rainbow before rain and the heavens.
Yeah, well, the easy part of the rainbow not existing then was, the scriptures are clear, it had never rained on the earth before. It was always a mist. The mist droplets are not adequate. You don't get a rainbow in the clouds from a mist. Now, you can have a mist coming off your garden hose and see a little rainbow down here, right? But you don't see it in the clouds. And that's where I go with it. Am I right? I don't know. I know I'm right in that the scriptures say this is the first time we had rain, and this is the first time we had a rainbow in the clouds or in the sky.
Thank you.
Work? Any other questions or comments? I'm glad you brought those comments up. Takes us down to verse 14. God's going to make another point here. It shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow will be seen in the cloud. And so God says, this is what's going to happen. We get the clouds, we get the rain that goes with them, really, and you're going to see a rainbow. And verse 15, and I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature and all flesh, and never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. And so in verse 15, he not only lets us see it and know that he made the covenant, but he lets us know he's going to see it and recognize it and remember it as well. And so it reminds us, but it also then reminds us that God's never going to forget that. And then in verse 16, He said, when the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And so he even goes ahead and repeats it again, and he says it's an everlasting covenant. What does that mean, everlasting? Well, clearly there's a limit here, and I don't want to try to impose something false on top of it, but go back to the previous chapter, Genesis 8, and let's look at 8, 21 through 22. Genesis 8, 21 through 22. Somebody read that for us.
And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done.
In 22.
Sorry. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease.
And so there's there is an expiration, if you will. It is everlasting in that we will never, throughout any time, see the flood destroy the life on the earth again. But there is a little bit of a limitation there in verse 22, while the earth remains. Is the earth itself everlasting? No, it's going to be destroyed by fire. It's over in Peter. We've mentioned that before. And so there is a time coming when this earth will be destroyed. We'll get a new heaven and a new earth. And so the promises about things on this earth, in a sense, have an expiration date. We don't know when it is, but someday there will be a new heaven and a new earth, and so what would happen on this earth becomes rather irrelevant. And so let's go on. Verse 17, God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. So God once again says, here's this covenant, count on it. And so it is there and it's real. By the way, what do we call this covenant?
Noah
covenant. Covenant of Noah. There's probably some other. I struggle with saying Noah, starting with the word Noah, because what do you put behind it to say the covenant of Noah? The Noahic covenant? I don't know. But that's probably not an extremely descriptive name. In one sense, it's super. It's great. Because this is said to Noah, right? But as you read through this covenant, this is a covenant with every air-breathing creature on the earth, right? And even the earth itself. He says at one point, it's a covenant between me and the earth. It is a unilateral covenant, meaning God established it. It's all God. It's unconditional. There's nothing that man has to do. And it is everlasting in that as long as this world is here, this covenant's going to continue to exist. And I will say that when Noah came off the ark, this was an extremely important covenant for him to know about. Why would you think that would be true?
Because he's going to pass it on to all generations.
Well, that's true. Let me tell you a story. Or run back into the one that we just got out of. Let me tell you a little story that helps me visualize it. When Jennifer it was before high school, but I don't know how far, she went with a group to a camping trip. They had cabins. It was great. It was wonderful. They were having fun. It was in a valley somewhere around here, and it started raining. They didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. And this is the kind of thing you would expect in Colorado or somewhere, but they were here in Kansas. I don't know where. It was a ways away. I know it was a long drive to go get her. I didn't do it. Ruth did it, so I don't remember where it was. But they realize the water's coming up. They look outside the cabin. They are going to have to wade through water to get away from this flash flood that's occurring in their valley. So they start gathering their gear. By the time they get ready to do it, they actually tied ropes between the kids, abandoned the gear, and barely got out. And the cabins floated away. for a while, if we had a good storm come up, Jennifer was scared to death. Imagine Noah. Is rain now necessary for life on the earth? Sure it is. What do you think Noah's going to think at the first thunderstorm without this covenant? Oh my. Particularly after we read the rest of the chapter and he has his own excursion into man's foolishness and sin. Oh my. Now it's us. We got it down to 8 and he's wiping out the other 8. And so this covenant was absolutely necessary for man to not live in terror every time a rainstorm came up. It would have been tough for Noah. Can you imagine the traditions that we would have? Well, he did it once. Been a few other scares for people that lived through the 51 flood. They would say, I thought it was going to happen then, but it didn't. And so mankind needed this assurance. If it was true. Now, if God didn't intend to do what he did, but if God's intentions were, don't live in fear of this, this covenant was really, really, really necessary. We still have floods, don't we? People still die in floods. We still have violent weather. People die in violent weather, but we do not have to fear a universal flood. And in fact, nobody really does. But there's something else that happens here. Let's go over to Matthew 5, 44 and 45. And what I want to talk about is common grace. Matthew 5, 44 and 45. Let's read that. And we will also then make some comments about it. Who's got that for us? Matthew 5, 44 and 45.
But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be the sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous.
Okay. So, in the world we live in after the flood, what can you tell me about sunshine and rain? How do they fit into our lives?
God gives them to everybody.
Well, God does give them to everybody. Are they necessary? Yeah, you just let it not rain for a couple weeks, and in our part of the country, you have a lot of people squawking about how dry it is, right? For good reason. Some of us, our livelihoods depend upon that rain directly. And for all of us, we know that if the rains don't come, life's going to get tough, either in food sources or something else. Is that happening right now in our country? Just go out and ask somebody around Las Vegas if rain's a problem or not having rain's a problem. And they're going to say, yeah, we need rain desperately. By the way, have you heard the recent solution to that? A pipeline from the Mississippi over to Lake Powell, isn't that the one by Las Vegas with the Hoover Dam? So we're going to transfer the drought over here, just send our water over there. But anyway, I don't know if that's very, well, it's somewhat serious by some people. But anyway, you know, just be short of rain. I went to Atlanta some years ago when they were watching down to inches one of their lakes that was the primary water source for the city of Atlanta. And do you know what's in Atlanta? Coca-Cola. And it was getting real political because Coke uses, do they think they use a lot of water? Yeah, they use a lot of water. And they were talking about having to tell Coke no more water. And that wasn't going very well. They got some rain before they reached that point, but that drought was pretty unbelievable in their eyes. So water is necessary, and here's Jesus. What's the setting for Jesus here? Do you know, have you recognized what the setting is when he's saying this?
Love your enemies.
Well, love your enemies. It's the Sermon on the Mount, where he's going through all of these things, trying to rearrange their thinking letting them know that the way they have been looking at life in this hard, fast, external way of living has an internal piece to it as well. But in these verses, he is showing them that God provides care, sustenance for life on earth, in particular people, and he does it for, he is the source of that sustenance, the sunshine and the rain, which are so essential to life, for a righteous people and for the unrighteous people. This is the establishment of God's common grace that we see, that is, I don't want to say it's the establishment of it because it already existed, but it's God's declaration concerning it when he talks to Noah. As a matter of fact, look back in chapter 8, verse 21. It was read to us just a little earlier, but go back to it. I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for what's still a true statement post-flood? The intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. But even despite that, the words don't say that, but despite that, I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. God's common grace to his creation, to the living part of his creation, is I'm going to continue to provide for you, even though there's plenty of evil around. There's plenty of reason for him to have simply just squashed the whole race, right? The whole planet, just like we would kill an ant. There was every reason for him to carry out his judgment in full on mankind. No one could have said God was unjust if he had done that. But so that his purposes could be fulfilled, borrowing words from Romans 9, and so that he could extend grace to us and he could glorify himself through the grace that he showed us, he still shows grace to the people of this planet. And part of his showing grace is saving those that have faith in him, his kind, effective calling of them out of this evil world. I want to take our last few minutes. I'll take any questions or comments if you have them first. But in here, God makes a covenant. And unlike men and their covenants, God keeps his covenants. You could say he keeps his promises. And I want to take a look at that. And I want to go over to Psalm 89. There's two passages or two parts of Psalm 89 that I want us to look at. I think it's very helpful to see this, and it puts in context what we've been talking about today with regard to how God handles his covenants even when mankind has problems with his own evil bent toward sin. First, I want to read the first 8 verses, and this is a testimony of God's faithfulness in keeping his promises. Now, before we're done, the part we're going to be focusing on is the covenant, what we call the Davidic covenant. It's a covenant about David and his eternal kingdom, his eternal throne being filled with one of his descendants. But let's start out and read the first 8 verses, which is a testimony toward God regarding his faithfulness and loving kindness. Would somebody read those 8 verses for us?
I will sing of the steadfast love of the Lord forever. With my mouth I will make known your faithfulness to all generations. For I said, steadfast love will be built up forever. In the heavens you establish your faithfulness. You have said, I made a covenant with my chosen one. I have sworn to David my servant. I will establish your offspring forever and build your throne for all generations. Let the heavens praise your wonders, O Lord, your faithfulness in the assembly of the holy ones. For who in the skies can be compared to the Lord? Who among the heavenly beings is like the Lord? A God greatly to be feared in the council of the holy ones, and awesome above all who are around him. O Lord God of hosts, who is mighty as you are, O Lord, your faithfulness, with your faithfulness all around you.
So, what's the testimony of this writer of the Psalm 89 regarding the faithfulness of God with regard to anything, but including the covenant with David.
It's everlasting.
It's everlasting. Is it dependable? Absolutely. As a matter of fact, in verse 8, who is like you, O mighty Lord? He's mighty, and your faithfulness surrounds you. That's just who you are. You're immersed in it. You are completely faithful at all times in every way. Excuse me. To see how that is lived out, we're going to get the words of God now. God speaking down in verse 28. And let's read 28 through 37. Jack, do you have that?
My loving kindness I will keep for him forever, and my covenant shall be confirmed to him. So I will establish his descendants forever, and his throne as the days of heaven. If his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they violate my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will visit their transgression with the rod, and their iniquity with stripes. I will not break off my loving kindness from him, nor deal falsely in my faithfulness. My covenant I will not violate, nor will I alter the utterance of my lips. Once I have sworn, once I have sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His descendants shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me. It shall be established forever like the moon, and the witness in the sky is faithful.
So here's God talking about his covenant with David. And what does he say about that covenant with David? I'm going to do it. What does he say he's going to do if David's descendants are sinful toward God, if they are not obedient, if they become evil themselves? What does he say he will do?
Punish their transgressions.
He's going to punish them. What happened to the covenant?
Remains.
The covenant remains. And of course, we know this covenant is referring to Christ. That's the eternal king on the throne of David. That's his offspring that's going to be established forever as the ruler in David's throne in Jerusalem for a while and then in heaven. And so it makes sense to us that his covenant would not be violated, that it would still be held as a covenant and he would fulfill it. But that's easier for us to realize than the Jews. Because when the Jews visualized the throne of David being filled forever with one of his offspring, they're thinking in worldly terms, not Christ terms, right? And so God just makes it clear. Yeah, they may misbehave. He could have said, and when they misbehave, just like he could say about us, and when you misbehave, I will use my rod on you because you're not illegitimate children. And so we can expect God to bring chastisement and discipline when we need it. But we also can plan on his covenants being upheld as long as he is God in the heavens, and that is for eternity. Questions, comments? Where?
It's on 28, it says, my mercy I will keep.
Okay.
And then it also says, which I kind of like, 34 says, my covenant I will not break.
Yeah, same thing.
And I don't know, it just sounds more.
Well, the word choices in translation are, can be different and still both be correct. So, all right, well, let me close with a word of prayer. Father, thank you for your blessing. Father, thank you for this covenant. Lord, thank you that we don't have to wonder every time a storm rolls through. what you're doing, or when the rains prolong, or the Mississippi floods, and it's still raining, what's coming. Thank you for your assurance. Thank you for your common grace. Thank you for seeing that this world continues and is sustained by your direction, determination, and your power. Thank you for your love for us, and really for all of the world. It's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.